Well, take two, audience, because we tried recording and it was only 3 minutes in. We thought we had a problem, but it turns out we fixed it. It's fine. But welcome to episode 7 of Hong Kong Gore. I am your host, once again, Wing Ho, and...
Matthew.
The second host. You know what? I hate that term co-host, because I don't really see you as my co-host. You know what I mean? It's like... I think we're equals in this
endeavor. Oh, cool.
Endeavor.
So we is equal. It's funny for a second when you say you don't see me as your co-host, and I was like, so we're not equal?
You know what? I always feel like... Oh, I'm the host and the co-host. And co-host sounds so secondary. It just gives me that vibe. But
yeah, no, I guess. Yeah, it's not,
you know,
like
it's
I'm,
like,
a, I'm the
it's
opening
kind
act
of like
or...
the actor or the co-star. You know, it just sounds so secondary, and I don't really like the vibe.
Co-starring.
Co-starring.
There's a freeze frame, like, and I'm holding a cup of coffee, going, "Hey,
hey," and then wake up the camera. But welcome to a.
Spooky.
Another exciting episode. Well, it's October. Yes, you're right. And Matthew, you gave a wonderful suggestion. Well, we were kind of going back and forth, actually, as we mentioned, because I wanted to do one film, but that Blu-ray is not released yet. So you were like, no, we can't do that. I was like, ugh. And then I suggested another one. We figured, yes. You know, that Blu-ray exists, and you know, we can have access of it. Apparently, there was no stock.
I wanted to get it, unfortunately, yeah. They didn't have any stock. But that same place, which is the Paris shop, Metaluna, which is really good for storing like import DVDs and Blu-rays for that kind of cinema, they basically didn't have it in stock at the moment. So I had to wait, but they did have in stock a movie which. You also had been gifted recently, which is Magic Cop,
yes.
A film by Stephen Tung Wai. So a filmmaker that hasn't done a lot of movies, but which is centered around the actor. So let me find him. So
Lam Ching Ying,
who's done a lot of spooky movies.
Yeah, he's the face.
Spooky in the sense of not
the,
spiritual,
the...
but like...
Well, kind of spiritual. It's basically the hopping vampire. Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah,
it's not a scary movie.
No,
really.
none of these films are overtly scary. They're atmospheric at best, but they're never scary. Kind of like similar in a way how Hammer Horrors are not that scary, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think they were meant to be scary at the time. They're less scary now. But
yeah,
I think Hammer was definitely kind of spooky, scary, jump scary kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think Hammer Horror was always being one of those genres where it was trying to appeal to a demographic. It's a shock factor kind of thing.
Yeah,
blood and sex, you know, and you know, kind of thing.
Exactly.
Whereas
yeah.
With these hopping vampire films, they're atmospheric, but they tend to play side by side with comedy. And I think a large part of that is actually Sammo Hung, because he's a producer in a lot of these films. So I can imagine that's part of his MO. But
so yeah, for Encounters of the Spooky Kind,
yeah.
Which
exactly.
There's two of them.
There's one from like I think it was 80
something. Yeah,
I think it was 81. I think it was sometime in like 1970, 1980. It's definitely early 80s. And then he made another one called Dead and the Deadly, which is also a cool film. And then in the early 90s, he actually made the second Spooky Encounters film, which I haven't seen, and it's a very hard film to get hold of. But
isn't he in Hocus Pocus too?
Oh, good question. I can't really say for sure. I know
it's definitely a movie of that kind. But
yeah,
before...
well, it is and it isn't. But go on, yeah, you know, let's go. Yeah,
yeah. Because before we move on, like, there's something you just said, and that's not going to be very familiar to a lot of people. Which is the hoping vampire.
Yeah,
that's very very Chinese thing.
Yeah, that's a very Chinese thing. So in Cantonese, they tend to be called. The term vampire is a bit of a weird name to
but
point them.
Turn people into the undead.
They turn people into the undead, and I think there's some discrepancy of what is a vampire and what is a zombie. And okay, so in Cantonese, they are known as gurn si, and gurn actually means stiff, and si meaning body or corpse. So the actual literal translation is stiff corpses, and the stiffness is—it's actually explained in two ways. There was one sort of theory is that, oh, because once you actually die, their bodies actually become stiff. Because their bodies have been like sort of bounded by chains, and they can't, and it's basically when they do reanimate, they're unable to sort of be released from those chains because their body are like, it's kind of, I suppose it's a sense of like, once you die at a specific state, you're forever in that state, even in your spiritual form. The more realistic, I would say, explanation is that when people, you know, when people pass away, the body goes through a stage of rigor mortis, which is actually much more of a scientific term and actually makes a lot more sense. Hence why, so these animated bodies, they can't really move their limbs properly because of their muscles being through that process. So all they can really do is hop. Exactly.
But zombies, on the other hand, are not stiff.
No, they're not stiff. In fact, they're on the verge of like bloody collapse. So I think out of my memory, Magic Cop is like the only film that really makes the distinction between vampires and zombies, actually.
Yeah, did you make that difference during the movie? I had to note it. I was like, oh, interesting.
Yeah, because they never really make that distinction in any of the films I've actually seen. So that's a really interesting sort of point to make. And I'm 80% sure that's not part of the go and see sort of Rajiv, if you want to call it that, you know?
I mean, the thing also with, and we're going to talk about it a lot more about this movie, is that anything that happens in terms of the occult in this movie is made up.
Yes. Yeah. A good, especially, and we even have director's confirmation that, anything that actually happens in this film is pretty much made up, you know?
They didn't try to like stitch up some kind of, you know, ritual that existed.
Yeah,
they only focused on the practicality. So maybe we can start maybe already like with what the plot is for Magic Cop, although it's pretty simple. The plot of Magic Cop is, I have it clearly in my mind, I can say it out loud.
Yeah,
it's the story of a cop who's capable of forming rituals and who's keenly aware of the spiritual forces, the undead, and so on. He works in a kind of remote area outside of Hong Kong.
Yeah.
And he's going to be drawn to Hong Kong for identifying the body of a relative. And he comes with his niece. With him.
Yes.
No real explanation why the niece lives with him.
Love interest.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, the love interest for the cop that they're going to meet. And then they meet two cops who are dealing with some spooky and spiritual crime and drug-related business, which is discarded very quickly.
Yeah, it's like it's never like talked about. Like, no, like the rest of the film. Yeah,
why vampires deal drugs?
Why does our villain wants to deal drugs? That's never explained. You know,
motivation.
Exactly. Cool.
And then the team up with two cops who are the fish out of water kind of character.
Yeah, they never
explained anything. They just go with the flow.
They really do. It's very much so. It's Michael Mew who plays I guess the comedic relief, and Wilson Lam is probably the closest we get to a conventional leading man. If that makes any sort of sense.
Sort of. I wouldn't call him the hero, though.
No, I wouldn't call him the hero either, because he's, you know, even like in the beginning, he comes across as kind of a sleazebag, actually.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say douchebag, but it's those are equivalent terms. Yeah, because he slaps the bottom of a co-worker, like the first time we see him in the office. He's like, you're that kind of person.
Yeah.
The movie tries to not be like the movie tries to have a main character, so the guy, the magic cop, played by Lam Ching Ying, which we didn't mention because we had a first take and we mentioned it.
Yeah.
is the reason this movie exists.
Yes.
Is yes. this guy. Exactly. He's the producer, but they also basically built the whole movie around him being the titular character for in Mr. Vampire from 1 to 3, Hocus Pocus. But he also is a guy who was also in production, like The Prodigal Son, The Way of the Dragon, Big Boss. So he's a very much a Hong Kong action movie staple. Like he's been there everywhere. He was also in Eastern Condors,
which we talked
about.
He's the one who got, you know, he basically grabs Yasuki Kurata's gun and gets shot, basically, you know, from there.
So he doesn't have a big role, but he's there. They got him there.
He's great. And I think he's definitely known as Master Cow in that role, the vampire hunting or vampire busting sort of Taoist priests.
I wonder how much this character and his casting has to do with his eyebrows, because those eyebrows deserve like to be like there's him and then there's the eyebrows, then the other actors are there, but like featuring. Lam Ching Ying and then his eyebrows.
Lam Ching Ying I don't know if this is like his choice or whatever, but Lam Ching Ying, whenever he makes an appearance, he always has interesting choices for his eyebrows. Like, have you ever seen the first Mr. Vampire?
Yes, I've seen the first
Mr. Vampire. Yeah, okay, so he has that big, massive monobrow, doesn't he? And like, and then, you know, in this one, he has.
I think that makes him look more stern and white.
Yeah, he does more stern, but then, you know, at the end of it, it's kind of like, it's like horns almost, you know, kind of thing.
Come on. If somebody here walked in the room right now, regardless of the fact that we're recording a podcast and nobody should walk in the room, but if somebody walked in the room and you'd see, like, that guy had massive eyebrows, you'd pay attention.
Yeah,
you'd
be true.
I wonder what this guy got to say. He's got eyebrows.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's the whole thing. That's the shtick, is like you see him on screen from the second he appears and you're like, oh, this guy is the hero material.
Yeah.
Look at that guy's eyebrows. So the guy's eyebrows, well, him and his eyebrows will then solve a crime. And that's basically the plot.
Yes. Very well. Very well done. I stopped a bit because I had to like sort of think about actually why did he get there? What's the main MacGuffin? And the main thing that kind of propels this plot forward is not necessarily the opening sequence, because that established more the Lam Ching Ying character, but it doesn't establish the plot. The plot only establishes when we reach into Hong Kong, where there's an undercover drugs bust, or an attempted undercover drugs bust, that is set in a snazzy restaurant.
Yeah, it's a restaurant. Yeah. Like we don't see a lot. Like this movie didn't have a lot of budget.
Yeah.
So we only see two tables, and that's kind of it.
They must have hired.
You know, it's a restaurant because people are sitting and there's waiters. So you know it's a restaurant.
Yeah, that's a restaurant. I was gonna say a members club, but that sounds a bit like.
Minbus, like, it seems more like classy than what it is. It's just a remote place.
Yeah.
And then there's a drug deal, but it turns out that the woman who's handling the drug deal is a zombie, a corpse.
Reanimated corpse. And, you know, I have to say, it's a very, the action here is actually very well done, I think, you know, because I always find that the Mr. Vampire films or the Guernsey films, in terms of action, they're kind of, I think it's largely due to the fact that it's a period, they're mainly associated with period pieces, that we don't, how they actually construct action around stiff corpses, it's actually quite difficult, you know, to make something quite unquote dynamic in the same way as, you know, let's say the 80s sort of kickboxing fight films you get from like Police Story or Tiger, or even like the Inner Line of Duty films. And then because of the period, they tend to like fall into the more traditional esoteric, you know, kung fu shapes that you see from like, let's say the 70s, you know, late 70s in particular. But the action, when you see the action with like stiff corpses, they have to like, I guess, have a much different approach in constructing those action scenes, because they have to like, they can't make these corpses fight like ordinary like kung fu practitioners.
Yeah, much that same way.
Yeah, exactly. And I think Sammo Hung did the only film that really came closest is Sammo Hung in Encounters of a Spooky Eye, where he does fight a corpse and the corpse does this pseudo. It fights with a very, how do I say it, a very staccato type movements, more so than you see from like the older kung fu films, and it's almost like voguing almost.
Because it's done on the tone of comedy.
Yeah,
it works
exactly,
with Sammo Hung style because he knows how to make things funny at the same time being like dynamic. So it works with him. I think though that there is also another thing in common with Encounters of the Spooky Kind is that the finale of Encounters of the Spooky Kind is basically a magic fight.
Yes, that's true.
And Magic Cop is basically essentially magic fights.
Yeah. We actually get, I think the closest we get to, like, let's say the finale of Encounters of the Spooky Kind is actually comes midway through the film where Lam Xingying and Michael Mu turns up to the main villain's lair and they have this brief sort of like spiritual fight where they use their own sort of like so the main villain Michiki Nishiwaki uses Frankie Chin's character as like a puppet to actually sort of fight Lam Xingying's own puppet who is actually the puppet being Michael Mu. So it's just very interesting how they actually try to like how they choreograph that type of scene, you know.
Yeah, but I think even when there's no confrontation, like the moment where when Lam Xingying is chasing the car, where they use like the GPS technique,
that's also
really perfect. And that for me counts as an action scene, just how the way everything is cut and like how tense everything is, like he's trying to trace the direction of the car using a ritual.
Mm.
That's the element that I think explains why. For this movie, the director, like, they made up every single ritual and didn't try to stick to anything.
No,
because they just wanted to make sure that everything was practical. So there's that connection between, okay, we're making rituals very practical because we're only doing things that are practical effect. Like, there's no CGI. There's, like, just stitching or touching things after the movie is shot, but like that's really, really very little.
So that's particularly true with I think even the director was talking about Michiko Nishiwaki's sort of like trademark daisy that she uses to control the corpses or the elements around her, you know, kind of thing. And
yeah, those effects are very well done.
Yeah, very well done. But it's very much this is very much her own version of Joss Paper, I think. That's how I actually read it. Because in Taoism, particularly in the realm of the Guernsey films, the Joss Paper is actually a way to sort of control the corpses.
Oh, you mean like you make a little picture in paper? And
So the Joss Paper
is like a doll.
Yeah, exactly. And it can be used as a doll, or you can just have one slip of paper and you just basically inscribe I don't want to call it a spell because that just makes it seem so weird. But you know, an incantation. You know,
spell I think works too for that.
Yeah, I suppose. And then you stick that Joss paper mainly in the forehead of the corpse, and that's how the Taoist priest tends to like control the corpses in terms of like hopping or leading them to a specific direction, or even making them do things that they, you know, they wouldn't normally do because they're dead corpses at the end of the day. And Nishiwaki's own sort of version of Joss paper is essentially the petals from her daisy. And it's very, it gives her character a sort of otherworldliness, which I think it's a very cool concept. I don't know what it says about her because she is portrayed as an overtly Japanese character. I mean, she is a Japanese actress.
She's a Japanese actress, but they do play on the fact that she's from, like, not a gang, but, like, a sect that's a merger of Japanese and Chinese culture when Japan started trading with China.
Yeah.
She actually is the one that has the biggest credits in terms of, like movies outside of Hong Kong, because as an actress, she's done plenty of stuff. Like she's she's in God of Gambler. Never forget.
And she was in she plays a lot of villain roles in Hong Kong, actually, particularly in The Live Duty 3, which I really thought she was cool in. So yeah.
But also in Kill Bill 1 and 2, she's a stunt person in there. She's in Blade. She's in Mission Impossible 3. She's in Collateral. Michael Mann's Collateral. She was also in True Detective. And crazy enough, she's also she's got a small role in Everything Everywhere.
As the competitor for Michelle Yeoh in one of the sort of other, not flashback scenes, but the multiverse flashback scenes.
Which to me again shows how much that particular movie, Everything Everywhere, was done by people who really wanted to get like a lot of people from.
Who knows Hong Kong
cinema.
Because
She didn't have any credits for a long, long time, and they definitely called her up. That sounds like we want that person, and she came out of retirement and be like, "All right, I'll do this movie with you. That's fun. I'll do a short appearance." But yeah, it's very rare, by the way, to have like a Japanese actress that has a prominent role in those kind of movies. When I saw her, I was like, really? Is really a Japanese actress? Like, it's not somebody who's pretending to be Japanese.
Yeah, that
really
is true. And I think that's a lot of that reason is by that point, Nishiwaki has actually made a name for herself as an action actress in those films. She definitely earned it because I think her first credit was in My Lucky Stars, where she played like a main villain. And then slowly she was gaining like recognition. I mean, for one thing, she turned up in the opening of God of Gamblers. And she made like such a strong impression in the opening of God of Gamblers that I was always kind of disappointed that she never really returned. Do you know what I mean? Later in the film, it's just one and done kind of thing. But it was very much a case in point where Nishiwaki was like, yeah, I made a name for myself, so I can actually sort of turn up and sort of play Japanese characters with a lot more heft, you know.
Yeah.
So and this was also done by the production company Movie Impact Limited, and Nishiwaki at that point was also known to doing like contemporary action films as one of the five films, particularly in the sort of girls with guns genre, where you know, with the likes of like Moon Lee and Yukira Shima. Oh, I've screwed up that name, but. But Movie Impact Limited did mainly contemporary action films, mainly like The Last Blood, Fun and Fury, Outlaw Brothers, which also Nishiwaki also turns up in, A Moment of Romance. She definitely has her own sort of niche there. She developed a very good niche with by doing these films.
Yeah, but she has an impressive CV for sure.
Yeah, when you go to
IMDb, it's like, oh wow, you've done a lot.
Which also leads to the next point about Magic Cop, in that it is essentially a Mr. Vampire type or a hopping vampire film,
yeah,
set
100%.
In modern day Hong Kong or contemporary Hong Kong. Contemporary by 1990s standards, basically.
Yeah, yeah. But contemporary to the point where they really emphasize the modernity of everything around, and the fact that the main protagonist is kind of out of time with whatever is happening.
Well, the way I saw it is, it's kind of like the Lam Zing Ying's character is essentially from the rural areas of Hong Kong, and he finds it hard to adapt to the more quote-unquote city fast life or the city slickers of like the urban Hong Kong, because he's known as kind of a country person. Same thing with the female actress. She's kind of seen as like, oh, you know, I want to go to the city and like. And, you know, it's kind of like how, I guess, someone outside of London comes into London and it's like, oh, it's the big lights, you know, it's the big city. And it's like...
It does, but the movie does give away that vibe, despite the fact that you don't really see any scenes that are set, like, with busy streets and everything is all very... very kind of like contained,
yeah. Which I wonder if that a lot of that is largely because of the budget.
Because
it's like I said, Movie Impact Limited, it their incentive is to make contemporary films because essentially they're easier. And if they were to make period films, they would have to invest a lot more money to essentially build sets and recreate a setting. Which Stephen Dunaway also explains in a really good interview in that
Blu-ray. Sure, yeah.
So
it's on the bonus of the Blu-ray. Really, like it's a really good interview. It does give a good number of insight into why this movie was made, how it was made. But the fact that it's so limited means that you have more interaction with the people. You don't see like big crowds moving around. Like you actually interact with people. And the reaction they have to me gave that movie a bit of a New York vibe because the way people react, they're either so blasé and uninterested, or when the cop played by Wesson Liam, when he tries to get a car, like he stops the car, he says like, "Get out, I need a car." And like I think in most Hong Kong movie, you don't spend time in that, like either the cop gets the person out and takes the car, or the person leaves and then you get in the car. In that case, the guy basically refuses and just backtracks him and goes away.
No, no, no. What happens was is that guy, I said, "Oh, all right," and then he just backtracks and just like,
it's very much like I got things to do. I've got things to do here. Yeah. And for me, it's really like kind of different. It gave a bit more of a like, everybody's got an attitude.
Yeah, it gave the film a lot more character for sure, compared to like other films. But I also really like the modern day setting, largely because it allowed the action to be, allowed some form of contemporary action to sort of like gel with the more esoteric elements or esoteric magic elements of like Taoism, which is why I expect from Nishiwaki. Actually, come to think of it, Nishiwaki doesn't really do a lot of fighting. A lot of the fight, but she does do a lot of pseudo acrobatics, which I really enjoy. But it was really Billy Chow who plays her, I guess, underling.
Associate underling. It seems to do what she says. They don't seem to have too much. Like she doesn't have to talk down to him. Essentially, she's just like, "We do this," and he does the stuff. But
Billy Chow is the one that really brings the kickboxing action of like, let's say, in the Nigeria films and the Police Story films into the mix. And which is why that brief bout or that brief scuffle in the final reel between him and Lam Jing-ying, for me, it was like a highlight because it was definitely combining the sort of like the magical elements with the more grounded fight action. And I actually really liked it. And I kind of, a part of me wished there was more of it, but I wonder if that's, you know, they need to spend more time with the esoteric stuff because frankly, those things take a lot, well, maybe just as long to actually put together, but also that was the thing they had to like sort of focus on because that's part of the Lam Jing-ying's character.
And also I think what I remember from the interview is that the director mentioned that they wanted to use the gimmick, they wanted to update the gimmicks, but they wanted to use those gimmicks, and using all that magical element meant that they could like bring back it and still make the film less of an action film and more of a, you know, occult esoteric comedy with all that. And what personally I enjoy about all of this is that compared to a lot of like Eastern Western movies where if you have vampires, you gotta have your cross, you gotta have your Jesus. No gods is ever mentioned at any point. The magic is very practical, and they never pray to anyone. It's mostly communicating with the spirits.
Praying is a bit of a weird term because praying, it sort of suggests that you're praying to a higher power. But with Chinese I'm going to call it superstitions or whatever. It's more about beliefs, exactly. Yeah. It's more about communicating with loved ones that has passed on, essentially. And that's very evident in the very opening sequence where the auntie accidentally extinguishes the fire that they burned gifts for the
For the departed.
For the departed, exactly. And then it's like, she has to like find a way to basically beg for forgiveness from not a higher god, but basically from like the departed, because they have the power to sort of like, essentially, if you piss off like the departed, they have the ability to essentially give you bad luck.
Yeah, and it, actually, that little scene is also made up. That whole hit ritual of like,
absolutely,
the little cut off,
it's
just a way, falling down, bending, bending.
To be fair, I think there is it is made up to a point. Like the whole idea of like burning, like the radio, that's actually real. That's actually so you do get that, but it's but then the idea of like communicating with them, it doesn't go further than that, you know, in terms of like communicating with like the departed. You only communicate with the departed is by gifts on joss paper or fake money, you know. That's the only way of communicating. And also just, you know, just and bowing with incense, essentially.
But that's the thing that I really appreciated with this movie, probably coming from the white people perspective, is that because I'm coming in like not knowing anything. When I was watching the movie, I thought like, oh, like I believed 100% in everything. And then at the end, when the guy explains in the interview, it was like, no, we just made it up. I was like, oh, it's even better. Because like there's always kind of elements that you have to bring in in Western movies to make it believable, and they have to be rooted in this. The fact that it didn't is even better to me. It's even more creative.
Yeah.
But I do agree, and for me, it makes complete sense that any of those rituals, even if they're made up, they're still grounded in just whatever they know. You know, it's we made up like a new belief. Like we basically went with, well, you have to.
What's the existing parameters of these rituals, particularly with Taoist rituals, and what liberties can we actually take? How far can we actually take it? Like, I think in the interview, Deng Wei actually mentioned about the, and this is actually a thing for the like the longest time, I think from the very beginning, where the corpses or stiff corpses or the Gansees, if you want to call it them, are actually, they get affected negatively from sticky rice. And it's kind of like that when he mentioned, it was like, that's, I don't know where that comes from. It's just a thing.
But then isn't that the nature of all belief, is that some region will have one way of seeing it, and then the other region won't have, like any like religion will have different variations of how you do the thing.
If there was a Western equivalent, how do you know fucking vampires don't like garlic? You know, it seems it's just one of those things. So,
Thing that they use in Encounter
of the Spook.
I found that fascinating.
And it's specifically duck eggs, I believe. It was a specific kind of egg, and it's kind of like, it's never explained why, you know, kind of thing.
It's never explained why garlic. I think, I can't remember which movie makes fun of this, where they show like a cross and they go like, why are you afraid of a cross? Like that makes no sense. It's just a cross. I can't remember which movie plays with that and say like, not all of those things are rooted only in like novels and everything, but we don't really care about this as vampires.
It sounds like when you say that, it just reminded me of one of the Halloween specials from one of the Simpsons Halloween specials, and it was the Bouvier sisters, where they tried to like steal away the Flanders's children, and he was like, come in and look at this, and then Flanders presents a cross, and they were like, oh please, just move aside. But they're not vampires, they're witches, so even that was kind of a bit like, all right.
But yeah, the thing is, in this movie they really just went with rituals have to match with whatever special effects we can use, like if it's just using like tracing something in sand, or saying, oh, this whole garden is a mix of glass and chalk, and that's good to bring back their dead, I'm like, I 100% believe it. Also, if the guy with the eyebrows says it, it's true.
It's true.
100%. Anybody, like I said, anybody that has those eyebrows, I believe. So it's completely fine. And it's also really funny to me that the other cop, so the comic relief character,
Michael Mew, played by
Ukiwai, he is like he basically goes very quickly over the overboard and goes like, oh yeah, sure, I'm following you to death, like yeah, sure, whatever you're doing.
Yeah, Wilson Lamb's like the more skeptical one. I knew Michael Mew was like, I'm with you all the way with this.
Wilson Lamb does have a bitching flat that modern buff. And that's really, and for me, that ties in with the feel of this movie being more New York-y kind of that kind of vibe. Because he has that flat with all those modern toys, including toilets that's actually a phone booth. Like,
I was like, but okay, quote unquote modern, or however you want to put it. It's kind of when he actually started explaining, that's how young people, we're more open like this. I was like, I wouldn't be open like this at all.
That's not.
I thought to myself, no, this is a house. This is not a young person's house. This is a crazy person's house.
This is a bachelor pad. That's what it is. It's the flat of somebody who's determined to be like, hey, coming into my lair, and I'll be a bit zany, but like you'll be attracted to that. I have no intention of settling in. The fact that, and I think the magic cop protecting his niece, he's there, he's bang on the money. Like he kind of cools down as the movie goes, but I'm like, no, you shouldn't let her hang out with him. He's terrible. He's not going to bring anything good to the family. You're like, what are you doing?
Yeah, and I kind of feel bad for the Michael Mew character, to be fair, because it's clear that the woman was more smitten by the
sexier?
Smarter?
He's a douchebag.
Yeah, and conventionally more masculine, comes off. I suppose.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. That's when the movie is, despite the fact that we have a lead character who's constantly trying to protect and who sees definitely his partner as a womanizer and he doesn't like it, the movie is definitely sexist, like 1,000%.
Oh, yeah. It very much kind of like...
dumb or...
Yeah.
And that's the only
The female actress or the female character has absolutely nothing to do but to provide a romantic tension. I'm not even going to call it sexual tension because I don't think it's not that. It's not really sexual, really. It's romantic tension, and it's kind of like, and it's like romantic tension. Where it's like, really? All right, I guess. And now I feel, to be honest with you, she comes across so childlike that it actually kind of bothers me a lot more because
she's definitely in her 20s, but she sounds like she's definitely not. She's like, and there's 16-year-olds who are much smarter than that.
Do you know what it was? It's the fucking pigtails that did it. And then her licking her lolly, like a child while reading a book. Yeah, and I'm like, that's a fuck this film, kind of thing. So I wasn't like... But it, which is why
go
I thought
this film, because it's good. It's good, but there were just moments.
Which is why I thought Michael Mew was a much more suitable sort of like, I thought they were going to get together because they seem personality wise, they're both quite childlike, because Michael Mew also kind of gives off that childlike vibe, or if somewhat immature vibe.
Yeah, like in The Good Place, the TV show The Good Place, with the two idiots.
Yeah, exactly.
Together,
so,
they get each other.
Yeah, but it's like, no, it's the girl wants the more, it's quote-unquote mature, handsome, masculine, whatever you want to call it.
It's more of an almost American trope. That's kind of also what the modern element of the modern setting of the movie gives off to me, is that I got the feeling watching this that they were kind of emulating some of the 90s American movies.
And
that dynamic, particularly having the wise cop and the young brash guy colliding and being like, at the beginning they don't like each other, and then towards the end they understand each other.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, that's very much like a not good cop, bad cop, but like a buddy comedy kind of dynamic. Which is, also really enjoyable about this movie. It really brings back nice memories of this, the 90s elements, all the technology is extremely dated, but also extremely fun. And it does have that subtlety too of making the, because the introduction of setting the tone with the whole ritual also brings the character of Lam Ching Ying as the representation of tradition, whereas the character played by Will Sun Yam is definitely the science guy, like the modern, like all
yeah,
modern.
And yeah.
Towards the end, they do embrace each other, like Will Sun Yam does recommend,
they,
like
they
recognize
do.
The values. So that there's that element of like, oh, they've, you know, without
they've
necessarily having
ground.
A scene where like, oh, you're not so bad after all.
Yeah.
It's, you know.
They reach common ground.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Did you reach common ground?
Yeah. I think it's also a good time to talk about the director, because this is, after all, Stephen Dunaway's directorial debut. Now, you did say correctly that he only made a handful of films or directed a handful of films, but he's actually known as an action director in Hong Kong.
Okay.
So he has made films.
Oh, okay, yeah, as a stunt coordinator.
As a stunt coordinator / choreographer, yeah. But he only, you're right, he only has made, like, he's... So there's a good portion of his career that he was actually, he was an actor. In fact, I think one of his first roles was... You've seen Enter the Dragon, right?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
So that kid that Bruce Lee kind of teaches in the opening reel of that film, that's Stephen Dunaway, that, you know, that...
That's impressive.
Yeah, right. I think he kept on acting, but slowly he was definitely moving towards action directing. And Magic Cop, I think this is purely observation. Now, I don't think it's actually official on record, but based on the interview that Dunaway has in the Magic Cop Blu-ray, he talks about combi key, the idea, which is essentially an early version of green screen, or very rough version of green screen. And, you know, this was 1990, so already he was learning about Hollywood special effects and how to apply it in his Hong Kong film projects, which is really interesting, because by the time Hong Kong films started making essentially Hollywood style action films with, you know, and trying to like combine it with their Hong Kong action films, but more so is trying to like appeal to a wider an international sort of like audience. Stephen Dunaway is probably one of those ones that successfully was able to make a name for himself as an action director during that time, because there were like films called Downtown Torpedoes, which is essentially a Hong Kong version of Mission Impossible, Jackie Chan's Accidental Spy, and Purple Storm, basically all films that he collaborated with the director Teddy Chen. All those films were deemed as like Hong Kong / Hollywood, Hong Kong film, Hong Kong action films in the vein of like Hollywood style or Hollywood scope, if you will. And Stephen Dunaway, I would say for the most part, has been the action director in all of them. And I think he was able to like take what he has learned in terms of like Hollywood style special effects and combine it with like the more fight / stunt action of like Hong Kong cinema during the 90s. You can see that there was definitely like a period where Stephen Dunaway was actually you know, making a mark for himself as an action director, and also as an actual, you know, a director himself, because he then made three more films, which if you look at them are very particularly like Fox Hunter was essentially a Girls with Gun flick, but because it was 95, it was on the it very much was leaning towards the more Hollywood style scope type films.
Right.
I've seen it, which was really cool. And then there was Hitman, which was essentially Jet Li's last Hong Kong film. And that in itself, again, combined fight action with a quirkiness that you see like from like Hollywood films. And then he made Extreme Challenge, which I haven't seen, but apparently it's kind of like a tournament film and was not very good, or at least not well received. I haven't seen it, so I can't really make a judgment. But yeah. I remember in the interview that Stephen Dunaway, he only made four films, but if he wanted to remake one of them, he didn't name the name, but he would remake one of them because he was not that satisfied. And I wonder if it was Extreme Challenge. I wonder,
right.
Because Fox Hunter is actually pretty popular among genre enthusiasts, and Hitman, I think, is a really cool Jet Li film, personally.
Right.
So I wonder if it is actually Extreme Challenge he was referring to, because he was definitely not referring to Magic Cop when he was talking in the interview.
He does talk about a few scenes in Magic Cop that he would redo. But he kind of makes a broad statement of saying, like, oh, like, every director does and thinks that, which I get, like, for sure. Like, you have something in your head, and then you don't necessarily achieve
that. And I guess that's any creative endeavor, is that you do it, and it's kind of like, oh, I could have done better on that, you know, guys. It's, it's one of those things.
It's what it is. For what it is, I think Magic Carp is a very, very entertaining movie. It doesn't have much depth. There's no real arc to most of the characters aside from those two, or things happen. I think there's some progression.
I suppose Wilson Lamb is probably the one with the biggest arc in that he begins as kind of a, oh, I want everything realistic, I'm kind of a sleazebag, and then at the end of it he's like, okay, I'm more open to the Lamjian character, because frankly he saved my life. If it wasn't for his knowledge, you know, all that stuff, he saved my life. And I guess the Lam Ji-in character has his own art, but it's never really... Okay, so here's the thing. This is another character, which we haven't mentioned, Wu Ma, who's essentially the commissioner of the police. And there's clearly a history between those two. And there's something in that box that kind of, like... It is the big thing that establishes the Lam Ji-in character in terms of, like, okay, this is, I accepted whatever is actually in that box, and that's my character arc completed. But we can only infer what happened between them, what that item actually means to them, you know, in the grand scheme
of
things. It's
like the tool that's used at the end to fight evil, but, like, you wonder, considering that Lam Ching-ying is definitely aware of what he's fighting, why then doesn't he just, like, is reluctant to take it?
Yeah.
I guess this hints as this being, like, something that needed to be explored in, like, other movies, prequels or whatever.
I wonder if it was already, like, it was something that they wanted to explore in the film, but they had to, like, cut it out, because these they have to be, like, 90 minutes long. I mean, this was an 88-minute film, and generally speaking, in Hong Kong cinema, Hong Kong, particularly of this period, your running time has to be 90 minutes or under, because essentially it invites more showings per day.
It does pack a lot of ideas. That's also the thing that makes Magic Carp a really effective movie, is that you're constantly moving forward with, like, new things being... Like, the only thing that maybe could have been trimmed down a bit is the scene in the flats where, like, they're sitting down. But, like, that sets up kind of the conflict between the two.
Yeah, and it's basically...
There's different attitude.
Okay, so that plays well with Hong Kong audiences, because that's essentially... because it's conflict within the household that brings up, like, relatable comedy that the audience is, you know, can actually recognize, because
and one of the challenge also with this movie, I think, for the director was to make Lam Ching-ying's character more relatable, and him like struggling with modern stuff makes him more of a, you know, comedy guy, because they seem to hint in the interview that because Lam Ching-yi is also a producer on the movie, and the project was, you know, built around him, like, that maybe had a bit of an attitude, and, like, also had perhaps just his way of thinking, like, about I want to do this, I want to do that, and then you had to negotiate with him.
Yeah, so Lam Ching-yi's he's actually, as a person, I don't know the person. I didn't know Lam Ji-in personally, but through, like multiple interviews, particularly, like, Sammo Hung, they always state that Lam Ji-in was someone who's always serious. He tends to be, like, very... He never joins in with a laugh. He's like, he does things quite straight and all that stuff. And I don't think that's necessarily... Perhaps that kind of, like, bled into his character, particularly the Taoist priest characters. But I like to think that he had his own idea of how his character was meant to be portrayed. And it's funny because I think Deng Wei in the interview says that Lam Ji-in never really acted as overtly comedic in any of these vampire films. I kind of disagree with an asterisk. I think it's just, for me, it's Lam Ji-in there, because the thing is that in the first Mr. Vampire film there is comedy, don't get me wrong, there is comedy,
100%.
But I think Lam Ji-ying, what makes comedy work is that Lam Ji-ying, he plays the straight man to everyone's buffoonery. And I think that's where the comedy comes from. And I think
it's in many ways, then.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think Magic Cop kind of does play on that, really. And,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
exactly.
Again, the eyebrows, like that whole, like the guy seems to be coming out of a comic book page. Like,
he
could be coming out of a manga, or compared to the more modern setting, like he seems to be coming out of a martial art movie. Like, that's kind of why they make fun of him, like when he walks in the police station, because here comes that guy, you know, like, wait, are you? Like, what is this? Like, the way you behave, the way you look, what you're talking about, nothing makes sense. Like, did you just step out of another world?
Yeah.
And it kind of does.
But that's
also what works with him, and what makes him such an entertaining lead is that you're drawn to him. Like, you're like, oh, well, I wonder what's going to happen with that guy.
It's the classic fish out of water type comedy that you see from like other films. You know, whenever there's a fish out of water sort of narrative, you either play it comedically or you play it quite almost like a horror or pseudo horror film.
It is and it isn't, because I agree that it is the fish out of water, but for me, fish out of water also means very often that you have to explain things, and that you're the person that's gonna be like, oh, we'll have to explain whatever ritual is happening or whatever tool is being used, that kind of stuff. They never do that. This movie, thankfully, doesn't spend any time saying, I do this because blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, they just do it very matter-of-factly. I think the only thing, an explanation that has to be done was when the Lam Ji-ying character actually explains the Japanese sex. That was the only time an explanation actually came in. But that's about it. He never goes too in detail about his rituals or his incantations or whatever. You know, it's like, okay, well, I'm gonna do this and just does them, you know, kind of.
That also means to me is that, I mean, it definitely wasn't the objective, but I kind of want this to be a TV show. Like, I'm up for watching this and being like, I know that he has done a TV show, but that seems to be more of a more period based.
It's more, I guess, plays on the more conventional. Yeah. No, you're right. There have been a TV series which also starred Lam Ji-ying as the Taoist priest character. I don't know if it's necessarily the same character. Haven't really looked much into it, but I know one actually exists. But I guess. In all these films, you know, you're presented these ideas, and a part of you kind of wishes that, I wish they could actually went a little bit deeper with this idea, you know. And I think that's just the nature of like Hong Kong cinema at the time, is that they throw ideas and see what sticks, and they don't really. And if it sticks, then yeah, maybe. But even then, when it does stick, it's kind of like, well, let's move on to the next thing now. It's very indicative of like Hong Kong as a culture, where that, you know, they move along at an incredibly brisk pace in terms of like putting content out there, you know, kind of thing. So,
but it makes the movie really, really enjoyable. The poster that was made for the reissue of the Blu-ray is actually gorgeous to me, but it has that busy quality of like having all those characters and like
hints
at the different scenes. I'm like, that's electric.
I quite like the painted quality. It reminds me of those old painted. Who's the artist who did those 80s posters like Indiana Jones and like Star Wars?
Oh, I don't know. But yeah, you're right. Exactly.
Yeah, it very much gives me that type of vibe. Sorry, fans of whoever did those. My cinema knowledge at the end can only go so far, unfortunately.
But yeah, the poster that they redid, like, the Blu-ray does have also a small scale poster, like a printed out that you can put out. And I mean, that's that's pretty great. Like, I think I'm gonna put it up because it's really, really cool. It's the kind of stuff where you're like, oh, that's a classic poster. Like,
yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, shall we also talk about the release itself? Because it's a pretty good release.
It's a very good release, yeah, for sure. So it's 88 films. They do a bunch of stuff. I know that they have coming soon. So Magic Crystal with Andy Lau and Cynthia Rothrock.
Which I actually kind of like. Yeah. Oh, have you seen it?
No, but I'm up for that. Like, based on the poster, I'm up for this.
It's and essentially also Cynthia Rothrock. Yes, exactly. You know what? If nothing else, watch it for the action.
Yeah.
But it's essentially kind of like your, what you call it? Cut price ET. That's how I'm going to describe it.
I'm fine with that. They're also going to do The Inspector Wears Skirt with, again, Cynthia Rothrock and Cedar Who.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess the Girls with Guns movie.
It's essentially Police Academy, but all female cast. Okay. If that makes any sense. I've seen it. I have a lot of fun with it. Particularly with the action scenes. But yeah, it's essentially Police Academy, but with an all female cast.
A bit more tasteful than Police Academy, that could be all right. I have flashes in nightmares of Police Academy movies, but
it's 80s Hong Kong, so I let you decide.
Your reluctancy says it all. And they're gonna also put out The Long Arm of the Law 1 and 2, which are
very cool films.
Yeah, I have them in really French subtitles. I'm glad that this is being reissued too, because that looked pretty great.
Yeah, those films are underrated because those films are like essentially pre John Woo Better Tomorrow and the contemporary sort of gun cop action thrillers of that ilk, particularly of like Ringo Lam and John Woo. So to have that come out and have hopefully a wider audience, it's great because there's more than Ringo Lam and John Woo. So yeah.
Coming back to Mr. Vampire, I don't know if we mentioned it in the first take or second take of the beginning of this podcast, but we do. There's the Mr. Vampire box set through Eureka. If you're curious about a lot of that stuff, because I mean that's kind of like the basis on which Magic Cop is based. It's the Mr. Vampire series.
I will say this though: Magic Cop is not the first contemporary vampire type film. I think that honor really goes to Mr. Vampire 2, which I haven't seen, but I heard was pretty ropey as a film, which is especially disappointing considering because it stars Yuen Biel, and I would have thought if you have Yuen Biel, the action is gonna like at least be
decent.
Yeah, exactly. But apparently it's actually one of the lesser vampire films, so I mean I would still watch it just to like because I'm that guy, but I'm gonna go in there with tepid expectations. But yeah, that box set sounds really cool. They did a documentary for that box set.
That's cool.
Focused on the rituals of like the Mr. Vampire films and how and where it's and the sort of the more real life roots, the roots of the more real life rituals that you see when Hong Kongers communicate with the departed. If anything, I would buy that for the documentary alone because it sounds really interesting.
Cool. And speaking of box sets, when I was in France, and that's definitely because we're an English speaking podcast, but I mean that maybe gives me hope that this will be issued with English subtitles, but I saw in France and told you about it a box set of all God of Gamblers movie.
Yeah, okay, so I will I will say
you will learn French.
I agree with you, but I looked into the box set because I was like, this is amazing. And then I looked into it and I was like, there's loads of God of Gamblers films, but the main ones is God of Gamblers, God of Gamblers 2, God of Gamblers 3, Back to Shanghai. And then there's another sort of, then there are two other films that kind of like, you know, have you ever like accounted a like two trilogies in one. So there's, you get the first film, but there's like two branches. Yes. To like, do you know what I mean? That's essentially what God of Gamblers is. So God of Gamblers, there's the first film, and then there's God of Gamblers 2, and then God of Gamblers 3, Back to Shanghai, which essentially focuses on the more comedic aspect because they both have Stephen Chow. But then on the other end, there is an official sequel. There's another branch that leads to God of Gamblers Return, which in Cantonese is called Dousan Dei Da, which essentially means God of Gamblers 2. I know, confusing. And then you get the prequel, God of Gamblers, The Early Years, which is number 3. That stars Leon Knight as the younger version of the Chow Yun-Fat character. And I'm like, what the hell? It's a mess. And that box set has them all, which is great. So that's 5 films. There's also this challenge of Challenge of Something. And that's kind of like a Shaw Brothers film I think is meant to be deemed as like an influence of the God of Gamblers series.
Right.
And then there's but what's missing that I've actually noticed was All for the Winner. I understand why it was missing, because it's actually under a different company. I think it was actually produced and distributed by Seasonal Films. The God Gamblers films were actually distributed by Wins Distribution or Wins Entertainment Distribution. But All for the Winner, it's kind of weird. All for the Winner was essentially a parody of the God of Gamblers films that starred Stephen Chow. But because that film became so big, they retroactively inserted that film as part of the God of Gamblers
series.
Yeah, exactly. And hence why there was God of Gamblers 2 and 3 Back to Shanghai with Stephen Chow, because it's essentially the same character. Okay. But they were missing that one film, and I was a bit like, damn. But I do have it on Blu-ray, so I'm not that bothered, really. But yeah, you're right. There is hope that those films will get an English subtitled friendly version released eventually. Hopefully, maybe by 88 Films, because they just released the first one on Blu-ray.
Ooh.
And so I'm kind of hoping they, you know, that film did well enough that the second and third film would come out, and maybe I don't know if they would do a box set necessarily, but
I'm something.
Yeah, I mean, the God of Gamblers 3, the early years, it's a hard film to get. I think you can import it, or if you don't want to spend the money and you want to check it out on iTunes, it's only £4, so
right, okay,
whatever. Yeah, so just to do what you want with it. But yeah, I have I really have like English subtitle friendly Blu-rays in my collection, and also Awful Winner, so I mean, at the moment, I'm all right.
Yeah, all right. So it's more for me to consider if I want to get that or not. But it is like a very, very nice surprise to see that admitted in Paris. I was like,
I do like the design of that box, personally. Yeah. So it was a nice design on that box.
Now,
if somebody
could also put out the From Vegas to Macau movie, I'm not against that. Because that's basically God of Gamblers too. I mean, that's also a God of Gamblers series.
Yes, I mean, I kind of like, I've only seen the first one. I remember kind of enjoying it, but apparently the second one and the third one,
I've only seen the second one. It was very funny, but in an over the top, almost Fast and Furious way.
They're Lunar New Year films. They're meant to be over the top, and they're meant to be kind of try hard in terms of like entertaining its audience to the point of well, this is a bit much, I think. I mean, Hong Kong Lunar New Year films, they're not meant to be high art.
Yeah,
that makes any sense.
Do you know the movie Detective Chinatown?
Yeah.
For me,
yeah,
that's definitely, like, that fits that description, and I really enjoyed the Detective Chinatown series.
Oh, okay, then. Oh, okay, well, in that case, then, okay.
I'm the target audience for ludicrous plots and, like, over-the-top action.
Yeah, okay.
That's the person you're doing the podcast with. That's the co-host. That's the person you see as an equal.
I still see you as an equal. Assessment. I mean, I am kind of silently judging you, but I still see you as an equal, so it's fine.
That's very kind of you. That's very, very kind, sir. Cool. Well, that's, I think that's it for Magic Cop. Although I have to say, there is a cat in this movie and it wasn't harmed as far as I
yes.
know.
Yes. Although it did. Okay, I will say this. The 88 films release is very good, but I think if it didn't bother me, but this was cut by the BBFC because of potential animal cruelty to that cat.
Oh, was it? Oh no!
Yeah,
because you
yeah.
can see it in the background hanging.
Yeah, but... and I don't. I thought when I looked at it hanging in the background, I was like, hey, it wasn't hanging by his neck, surely, you know, kind of thing. But I'm not so sure what because it did involve throwing that cat towards the Frankenstein character, and I was like, oh, I don't know about that, you know. But all so right. I think that's why. So the UK version of 88 films release of Magic Cult is actually cut by the BBFC because of, you know, animal cruelty grounds, which, you know, fair enough, quite frankly.
But, yeah, but, you know,
yeah.
I
mean, I am very much. I'm on the fence of like, oh, I like my films uncut and uncensored kind of thing because it's like in its original form. But you know, at the same time, if it doesn't really affect my enjoyment of the film, like it's like, oh, what the hell?
Yeah, exactly. So, like,
so no, so right. without that, I'm kind of like, you know, in this case, I'm kind of okay with it. So. Yeah. It's fine.
That's what it is.
It
all
is
right.
What it is.
So thumbs down a bit for the use of for the animal cruelty. Sorry about
yeah.
the cat. I didn't know that.
Sorry. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not officially confirmed, but they didn't officially confirm that cat was unharmed, if that makes any sense. So
Jesus.
They had to like, yeah, exactly. Yeah. But, you know, entertaining film. Entertaining film nonetheless. You know, definitely a good film for October. This is probably a good time. Are we going to do, which film are we doing?
Are we teasing which movie we're doing?
Yeah, we might as well. I mean,
okay,
screw
so
it,
the
you
next
know?
Movie should have Cynthia Rothrock in it.
Okay. All right. Okay. I like that.
We'll stop it at there. Well, you'll see in time.
All right, cool. All right, well, thank you. And, you know, have a great day, evening, morning, you know, whatever. And, we can plug our socials because
yes.
I have my social. So I'm on Blue Sky. I'm on, under the name of Bronze Lan with an N for November. I haven't posted a lot. If any, I've only posted my Hong Kong Gore artwork, which again, thank you, Paul Shin, for actually providing us with the artwork.
Salute.
Really great. Salute. I'm also on Instagram. My Instagram is more like a business card when I'm doing like performances and stuff, but it can be a podcast. I'm under winghlin, so just look me up.
And we are on Instagram under hongkonggore.podcast.
Yes.
So there will be a link to all of this in the description of the episode, so definitely look that up. hongkonggore.podcast. And there you have a link there also to my personal profile as well as Wing's profile. So everything
yeah.
can be found there.
And, you know, seriously, let us know your thoughts about the podcast. And it can be good, it can be bad. It can be even be like, oh, can you do a film, you know, do a podcast on this film? It can be
yes.
anything. Just communicate with us. We need social interaction.
That sounds so desperate.
Some kind. I mean, I'm
so we're happy for feedback, so definitely send it over.
Yeah, no. Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, I would say I want to end this podcast to say, you know, have a great Halloween if you're into that stuff, and if you're not, then
have a great October.
Have a great October. Exactly. Have a great October. All right.
Bye.
Bye.